share some information with you about personality type. Just to give you a little bit more about my background, as Peter said, my name is Ed Everts, and I do leadership development coaching. So I mostly work with senior business professionals in business and corporate environments, and I work with them on a whole variety of activities and opportunities. Typically, they are experiencing some type of challenge or something's going on in their work environment where they would love to engage with somebody external who's objective and provide them some clarity and insight, maybe some things that they might be experiencing. So that's generally what might happen in many types of coaching engagements. Just a quick background, I guess. I'm a lifelong human resources professional. Spent most of my career initially in retailing. So although not all of you are from New England, if you remember Filene's, Jordan Marsh, and Leachmere, spent a number of years working there, that large local retailers in this market. Left retailing and made a decision to go into business services. Went to work for about a decade at a company called Iron Mountain, which does records and services management. So yeah. Are you a client?
Yes.
Right, all right. So.
Framingham is.
You see their boxes everywhere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So,
Framingham, yeah.
Yeah, we used to have on our intranet either videos or pictures of places where people saw an Iron Mountain box, right? That might be on TV and CNN as a court case, and they're coming in with the box, right? Or
wow.
TV show where the truck drove by. So it used to be a lot of fun to kind of spot Iron Mountain. So I did that for about a decade, and then left there in May of 2008, made a decision to open up an independent practice, providing what I described earlier, independent leadership development coach. So part of my practice, a large part of my practice, is working not only with individuals, but also helping them build self-awareness. And one of the tools that I've used throughout my career, and that in my own practice now use to a great degree, is helping them understand and build awareness through deeper understanding of their personality. And one of the tools that's used for that to a great degree is the MBTI. So while we're going to use the MBTI today as kind of a tool to make personality type a little bit more real for you, it's important to point out that MBTI, for example, doesn't own personality type. We'll talk a little bit about that. They're one of the vehicles on which it's brought to the world, but it actually exists in a whole variety of ways and fashions, and there's even other tools out there that allow folks to bring personality type to their clients. So we've got a session today where we're going to talk of just a few minutes about origins, just to give you some background. We'll talk a little bit about myth-busting. Share two or three things that I think would be helpful for you to understand and get clarity on. We're going to talk about the preferences. We're going to talk about preferences and how those lead to personality types. Certainly we'll leave some time at the end for some thoughts, observations. They don't always have to be questions, but if there's something that you'd like to share with the group or some insights or experiences that you've had as it relates to personality type, that would be a great opportunity to do that. And obviously, if you have any questions, those are welcome as well. And then in the last half hour, we're going to do somewhat of a self-paced exercise with finding a partner in the room. Okay, so it's important to point out that personality type has very ancient roots. This is not something that was created when you went online and completed this assessment and was able to produce some type of outcome, but the study of human behavior and the study of human dynamics go back longer than any of us can imagine. And early individuals like Hippocrates, who we can all have some degree of familiarity with, spent time thinking about personality type. And he had a lot of ideas and a lot of ways of thinking about personality type. And he went at one point to a marketing agency in New York City with his ideas about personality type. And they came up with really great, great names to describe them, like phlegmatic and sanguine and choleric and things like that, which I don't think most of us today could really relate to. But some of those themes, like melancholic, continue even through today, right? Melancholy and things of that nature. So thoughts and ideas and things about personality existed way, way back then and obviously continued to age. So in around 1920, a Swiss psychiatrist by the name of Carl Jung produced what's considered to be a fairly seminal work called Personality Types. And Carl took a different view than most psychiatrists of that era, like Sigmund Freud, and he suggested that rather than having a common way of kind of our mind connecting with the world, that actually we had what he considered to be what were called preferences, and that we actually functioned differently in the world. So while we had a few archetypes that were similar as beings, how we functioned in the world actually varied. And he also said that because these functions varied, there were characteristics that demonstrated those functions that we could see. They were measurable and behavior-based. And those functional characteristics could be typed. And so that's where the concept of kind of personality type came from. They're representative of certain characteristics and behaviors that we demonstrate that fall into the various categories that he assessed. So that was quite dramatic at that time. And he became ostracized in many areas of the psychiatric community, including with, I don't know if he was friends with Sigmund Freud or not, but they had very different perspectives and stances on how the human mind worked and interrelated with its environment. So that work sat around for a number of years until sometime in the 1950s, when two individuals, Catherine Cook Briggs and Isabel Briggs Myers, stumbled across, literally, as the story goes, dusted off Carl Jung's work, and were so taken by the insights that he had, decided that their life would be spent bringing his insights to the world. And how can we help people understand what Carl Jung was suggesting, and how can we help people not only build self-awareness, but also understand how we differ? And that was their true goal. Their true goal was the spirit of helping us all understand how we might differ in different situations in different ways to build communication and relationships. And in fact, Isabel wrote on her end a fairly seminal work called Gifts Differing, because she looked at personality and the ways that we interact with the world as a gift, and that they differed from person to person. So they got together, Isabel and her mother, and they decided that the way to do it was to create an assessment. A way for people to go in and through forced choice select certain things that resonated with them most. From that, they would produce some type of outcome that would give a person an indication of what their personality style might be in most situations. And so that's how what we know today, 50, 60 years later, as the MBTI, the Myers-Briggs type indicator. So it is by far the most dominant type of personality type assessment in the world. Over 2 million people in the U.S., let me rephrase that, over 2 million assessments are done in the U.S. annually, because people can take them more than once. So over 2 million assessments are done annually in the U.S. It's been translated into over 30 languages, and it has 50 years of real effort done in respect to continuing to measure and evaluate its validity and reliability. So reliability speaks to the degree that you take it again and again, and that's generally consistent. So it has what's considered to be a very high degree of reliability. And then validity is the ability for something to do what it says it will do. And so it also has a very high degree of validity in the circles of folks that study that stuff, not me. So that's how the Myers-Briggs came to be in the assessment that you're taking. So I really liked Bob's presentation last week, along with Marianne. And one of the things he talked about was myth busting. So I said, hey, I'm going to do that. So I'm blatantly stealing. I was inspired by his presentation in respect to thinking about things that we think, and then are there really things? So we're going to do about two or three myths that might exist, and I'm not suggesting they do for all of you, as it relates to Myers-Briggs. So the first one is that we often think that the Myers-Briggs is a test. And no. So it's not a test. Tests infer that there's a right or wrong answer. Tests infer that there's a pass or fail. We think of tests as it relates to like a driving test, academic test. I'm sure we can all relate to those. Will my spouse remember our anniversary test? Those types of things. Either you're in, or you got it, or you don't have it. But MBTI is really a preference assessment. It's going to provide information that allows folks to think about and apply information in a certain way. So there is no right or wrong outcome. There's no good or bad outcome. So who's a fan of Mythbusters on TV? Anyone? Cole, so what do they say when...
Busted.
There we go.
What do you mean?
Not to put you on the spot, but I did.
That's okay.
Okay, the second one, personality type confines you to certain behaviors. So if there's anything that exists throughout the work of Isabel and Catherine and the many people that follow their efforts, is that personality type is meant to be a preference. Hence the name Myers-Briggs type indicator, right? It's not meant to be a box that we jump in. It's not to be a place that says, well, you can't do that because you're not this. It's believed to be a preference. It's believed to be something that's hardwired in you, that at that moment of instinct is probably where you're more likely to go. But after a moment of thinking about it, you might go a different way. So, you know, I like to think of it as, you know, if you hear a gunshot, the first thing you do is duck. I mean, but then some people run. Other people go to where it was, right? We all have different reactions. And that's how they look about as to a type of personality. Another thing that some of my colleagues do from time to time is have you sign your name with your left or right hand, depending on your left or right-handed, and then have you do it with the other hand. And while it's more awkward with the other hand, you can still do it. You could probably even get better at it over time. So that's kind of how they structured the way to look at and what they truly believed, the information that came from these assessments. So, okay, Nicole, I'm going to give you a second shot now. So,
busted.
There we go. She's redeemed herself. Nice show. All right, so the third one is results will be the same every time an individual completes an assessment. So sometimes we get a little stuck in this world of if I complete an assessment, it's the same assessment, I should get the same answer. And the reality is that as years and years of information has been collected about Myers-Briggs, the frequency that somebody will have the same outcome is very high, although it's recognized that from time to time the outcomes may be different. And then the reasons for the outcomes being different just vary dramatically. It could be the environment somebody was in at that time. Maybe when they took it a few years ago, they were in a very high-stress environment. Years later, they might be in a much different place. And so the outcome in the way that they think about type change. As people age, there is a belief that the things that they may have indicated when they were younger have changed because they've been able to learn to manage them more effectively. So experience and time has allowed us to manage our preferences a little bit differently. So maybe we look at them a little bit in different ways. So so the possibility that outcomes will vary from time to time does exist within the assessment. The last thing that might be a factor is, and we'll look at this in a little few slides, is within Myers-Briggs and within the tool, there's degrees of clarity. So everyone isn't who comes out to have a preference for extroversion doesn't mean everyone is the same when it comes to extrovert. So with even those dimensions, there are degrees of clarity. So for folks that have a lower degree of clarity for extroversion or sensing or thinking or whatever we might be talking about, for them, the assessment may not feel accurate because for them, it's just not as clear. As opposed to someone who you can imagine who's very clear says, oh, yeah, that's me. Yeah, I don't even think about it. I mean, that's me. You nailed it, right? So there are various factors that might lead someone to have different outcomes as well as not be as comfortable that the outcome that they've come to would be accurate. So who was that, Tara, who said, do it? Thank you. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the oops, that didn't work. That's what happens when you go from one computer to a different computer. So that should say that, that's a one. And what we want to talk about now is the four preferences. But I think, you know, before we do that, I'll just pause here just for a quick second and see if anybody has a question about or observations or comments about what we just discussed.
Sure. Is it thought that the day-to-day variability lowers the year-to-year variability?
Yeah, I don't know the statistics specific to the day-to-day. So I think the work that's been done is really over a span of time. I think the argument would be made that day-to-day it's going to be very consistent. But over time, there's a certain percentage of likelihood that somebody's outcome may change. And you may bump into folks like that. They say, oh, yeah. When I was younger, you know, I tested, and I said that word. My assessment came out as a, you know, as a feeler. And now, you know, I'm in my career, and I've got all this responsibility, et cetera. It's coming out closer. So you'll hear that from time to time. People have that reflection. Any other? Okay, so there are four preferences, which you saw in the assessment that you took, and we'll talk about each one. And then we're also going to do a little bit of an exercise as we go through each one just to help you understand a little bit more and hopefully to help the information stick. So Carl Jung, again, in his efforts and observations and studies, came out with, you know, ways of how we function and work in the world. And the first one that he talked about had to do taking the labels away from it for a minute. I think also times you also get stuck on, I'm an introvert, I'm an extrovert, blah, 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 blah. But behind that is some real interesting ways of thinking about MBTI and personality. And so the first dimension is really this focus on, you know, from where do I get my energy and to where do I apply my energy? So if you take a moment and think back about your day, your week, your life, you know, you'll find that there are times where there are things that draw you and there are things which have no interest for you, right? There are things you get very energetic and excited about and there are things that really hold no interest for you. So it's not much different than this first dimension. Carl Jung believed that there are things and ways that we function in the world that help generate energy and from where we get our energy from. And he labeled this particular dimension extroversion and introversion. An extroversion is defined as somebody who gets their energy from the outside world. So these are folks for whom their energy comes in the outside world. And they get their energy from the outside world. One way to think about it is if, as somebody who's an extrovert, that I've got a battery pack on my back, right? Everyone can see it, and I get charged when I'm connecting with people and talking with people and standing and talking in front of people. Conversely, he believed that there were people who had a preference for introversion. And these are folks who get their energy from more of the inner world of thoughts and ideas. And for them, their battery is inside. And they get charged when they turn inside and start generating that battery in respect to how they interact and function in the world. So as I mentioned, you know, on that dimension, he called it either extroversion and introversion. And actually, I want to pass out a just take one thing. Pass it down.
You'll take one and pass it down.
We're going to go through a little exercise. So I'll wait till everybody has their booklets. Okay, so everyone have a booklet? What I'd like you to do is just take a minute, as we do have to manage our time this afternoon, just take a minute and go down the list of descriptors that are on page one. So turn to page one. And go down the list of descriptors and check off which one sounds as if it's more extrovert or more introvert. So again, just take a moment to... We won't be turning these in. We won't be reprimanding anybody who maybe didn't choose wise. You have a 50% chance of getting it right or wrong by connecting with people, outside experiences. And introversion is defined as folks who have a preference for the inner world, inner world of thoughts, ideas, etc. Thinking. So work out ideas by reflecting on them. Anybody want to be brave and jump out here? What was it? Very good. Excellent. All right, we're going to plow through these. How about focused and contained? Work out ideas by talking them through. Excellent. Energized by privacy. You guys are on it. Have broad interests. Unless this is kind of like church where you're getting the wrong answer, but you're saying it so quietly no one can hear you singing the wrong words. Has anyone ever sung in church without really singing anything? All right, have broad interest. Broad interest. We'll come back. Again, well, but Francine, no, I mean, that's a valuable observation. Keep in mind, for purposes of today, these are not meant to define, and people can move in and out. Your clarity may be different, and you may be in that place where, you know, this is how you're looking at yourself today. So there is no box that says In fact, if we were to be going through a deeper exercise, I would have you check those, and I would guarantee that some people would not check if introverts or if they were defining themselves, if that particular definition doesn't fit. So all of these don't. If Myers-Briggs were so brilliant that they could figure out an assessment that had all these definitions that fit everybody every time, then they were way underestimated, right? So you're absolutely right. They don't all fit everybody at every time. But for purposes of today, we're talking about generally where are these going to go. Okay, how about have broad interests?
Extroversion.
How about live it, then understand?
Extroversion.
Sociable and expressive?
Extroversion.
Understand it, then live it?
Introversion.
Focus on their depth of interest?
Introversion.
Am I lost? There you go, thank you. So, anybody want to talk about any of these that are up here, just while we're in it? Judy.
So it's very interesting to me because I've taken this at various points in my career, and I started out as more of an introvert than an extrovert, and over time, I've sort of moved to the middle, and I'm not really strong on either one. I really love my privacy and time to reflect on ideas because I have, sometimes I think I have so little of it, and yet I do talk about ideas. And I actually talk through ideas, so it's been very interesting for me to, you know, in taking this time after time to see my my metamorphosis, if you will, you know. But it's interesting to understand it, and you know, if you are an introvert, you have to learn how to put yourself out and in a crowd and how to talk about ideas in a broader group, and so you know it is something that's malleable, if you will, if it's something that you want to work on.
So I think it's worth repeating, at the risk of being redundant, that these descriptors, and as you take some time to look at Myers-Briggs in detail, or if you go online, you'll see lots of resources that have lots of descriptors. But at no time is anyone going to say you'll fit all of these, because you could do them alone. But what it talks about is a predominance. Or your preference is in this particular area. But yeah, I could also do a few of these things. And you may elect to do them well based on your environment. Yes, Amelia.
One of the things that I find interesting is I participated in ELAM and there were 48 women. And in my learning community, some of the people that I thought were like really big E's, really big I's. And the way that somebody framed it that helped me understand it was, how do you recharge your batteries? It's not how are you in public, it's how. You know, what recharges your soul? And that helped me understand, because there's some very, very extrovert introverts, if that makes any sense.
Well, let's go with it.
No,
I think that's a great way to look at it. Yeah, it goes back to energy, and how do you recharge your battery, right? Some people recharge by getting out and going and needing to connect with people in order to recharge their energy. Others turn internal, right? And they recharge their energy on the inside. Okay, so let's keep going. So the second preference is this concept of how do you take in information. And for Carl Jung, this was kind of a mental function, this idea of how you take in information. And he thought of it in one of two ways, again, on this dimension. On one end is this concept called sensing. And sensing, he originally called it sensation, because he looked at it as people who need to take in information through their five senses, touch, feel, see, hear. So they needed something very tangible in order to take in that information. On the other end were what he called intuitives, people who didn't need that same degree of tangibility, but just kind of took in information in a very holistic way. One of the examples I've heard that I kind of like that isn't perfect, but kind of helps you see it a little bit, is if you were taking a picture of an individual and in the background was, mountains. So a sensor typically would focus on the person, and the mountains in the back would be a blur. That's not where their attention goes. They want something that's closer and tangible that they can touch. Whereas an intuitive would be the opposite. The person up front would be blurry, and the background would be clearer to them, because they could just see the bigger, broader perspective of how certain things connect. So let's do the same exercise as it relates to sensing. So if you just take a minute and go through your list and we'll see if we can connect some behaviors and characteristics to sensing.
Jump start the way that you look at how you
personality descriptor. How about oriented to present realities? How about trust experience? Yeah, so for our purposes today, it's sensing. So there's a few tough ones here, by the way.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell us.
This is a tough one. So, right, we all trust experience, right? I mean, to some degree. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they do and nobody else does. But in the preference, in two people talking, and I say to Amelia, hey, I want to do X next week. If I'm a sensor and Amelia is an intuitive, first thing, let me rephrase this. Someone else says to us, we want to do something next week. And I'm a sensor and Amelia is an intuitive. It's more likely that I'm going to say, well, how have we done it before? Why? What did it look like last time? Whereas Amelia, as an intuitive, might say, tell me more about that. Why are you thinking about it that way? What do you think we're going to get out of that? So neither are wrong or neither are right. It's just a natural place that we go to. So generally speaking, a sensor might be somebody who just puts more value or might go to experience first. Maybe trust is a little bit of a, not a good word. Oops, I gave that one away. How about remember specifics in a system? Actually, this was the other hard one that we looked out. So this is a trick. So this was a trick question.
Yeah.
A little bit. So sensors will remember specifics. So sensors have a greater likelihood of remembering details and specifics. And trust me, I know I'm married. So intuitives, they remember details. So this goes to this, well, I do. But they're more likely to remember details as part of a broader system. So if it's a system of things that they can envision, oh, yeah, you do this first and that first and do that, you know, what's your checking account number? I don't know. Who knows their checking account number, right? I mean, so forth and so on. So, you know, that kind of thing. So that was another tricky one. How about imaginative and verbally creative?
Intuitive.
Yeah. Again, are sensors not imaginative or not verbally creative? Of course not. They share some of those characteristics, but the ones that are more dominant to be imaginative and verbally creative, or more likely to go there first, are going to be folks who have a preference for intuition. And those that have a really clear preference for intuition are going to be wildly imaginative and wildly creative, beyond what any of us can like. All right, how about sequential?
Sensing.
Yeah, sensing. So you're getting that sense of tangibility, right? Things go a certain way. There's a certain order in that process. Factual and concrete?
Sensing.
Trust inspiration?
Intuition.
Random?
Intuition.
Right, so sensors are more sequential. This. Intuitives may be a little bit random. You know, hey, let's do that first. We'll come back to that. Don't worry about it. We'll do that later. We all know people like that, right? Hey, don't worry about it. We'll do it later. Oriented to future possibilities.
Intuition.
And observe and remember specific.
Great.
All right, so the next one that Carl thought about and talked about is this concept of how we make decisions. So remember, sensing and intuition is about how we take in information. The next one is about how we then make it decisions based on that information. Because we take in information differently, and then how we make decisions based on information is going to be different. So we talked a little bit about this concept of, how do we make decisions? And he found that people made decisions in generally, again, we're talking in generalities, one of two ways. The first way is a person who's able to step out of a situation and look at it objectively. So something happens, they can just step out of it and say, here's what I think is happening. And he called those folks thinkers. And then you have people who observe the same situation and step in and look at it from the inside out. And he termed those people feelers. Now, this particular category always gets people a little bristled because of the naming, right? I mean, think of this. These are names that were created at the turn of the century, right? So by no means are we suggesting that somebody who steps in is a little bit more subjective and wants to understand what's going on and look out doesn't think. No more are we suggesting that someone who can step out of a situation, look at it objectively, has no feelings. And this always happens, right? Someone who comes out as a clear thinker is like, but I've got feelings. I've got feelings, and a feeler is going to be, what are you saying? I don't think. So I wish I could name these a little differently, but unfortunately they are what they have. But that's why I like spending more time thinking about what they mean and how you describe them, and you know, kind of the labels that we assess with them. So, you know, a quick example might be in my house, I have a 13-year-old daughter. She comes home from school and tells us about a grade she got on the math test, which was less than stellar. My wife has a preference for thinking, so the first thing she does is step out and say, well, tell me about what happened in class. You know, what was the score of everybody else? What's the bell curve? Not in this voice, I'm just doing that melodramatic purposes. You know, but she steps out and looks at it very objectively. I have a preference for feeling. So I step in and say, oh, honey, you okay? You know, you're going to be all right, you know, so forth and so on. But then I quickly shift to, but yeah, let's get back to class. What happened? Tell me a little bit more about it. Or my wife shifts it to, let's sit down and talk about it, et cetera, et cetera. But our first, you know, natural inclination is to kind of look at it a little bit differently, because that's how we're making decisions about the information. Let's, once again, to no great surprise, look at this particular analytical. Except first. It's a tricky one. What was it? Right, we'll come back to that one. So, except first. How about assess impact of decisions on people? Going to be their first place they go. Like I just gave that example. It's not my, what my wife doesn't feel or I don't think, but the first place I go is, are you okay? Empathetic. Likes things to be personal. Drawn to people. Question first. Drawn to data. May appear tender-hearted. I told you all that. You all thought you were so smart. Okay, let's. So I wanted to talk about accept first, question first, right? I mean, that's just a great little descriptor. Again, we're not suggesting that people who think don't accept, or people that feel don't question, et cetera, but the first place people go, based on the clarity of their preference, is going to be either to accept something they've heard first or to question first. So a person with a preference in the thinking side of the dimension is going to, it looks for rationale, looks for answers. They want to get clarity on what is occurring before they start thinking about the implications. But they'll get there. People with feeling are going to accept first and then step out of it a little bit, right? Then they're going to start hearing more and step and getting answers and questions. So again, it's the, do I step out, look at something objectively? Do I first step in and look at it from the inside out, look at it subject? Okay, so let's, please go ahead.
The longitudinal history, this is pretty interesting, the T versus F, because in an academic setting, it's very stigmatizing to be an F. And when I took this, if you see, I'm like just on the line, just over in the T. And when I, you know, and then they were like talking about it, I realized I was like a T fraud. You know, because basically to be in an academic setting, you have to be inculcate the value system of where you are. You cannot be a cardiologist if you're a healer. I mean, you've got to be a thinking person. And
it's an interesting that you brought that up. What I was saying before was when I was taking the assessment, at each question, I was like, well, I'm kind of different in my professional life than I am in my personal life.
Right, yeah. Right.
Even for a given question. I mean,
Is that pretty typical? That's what my reflection. I was trying to keep my head. I mean, I sound like I have a personality or something, but I was trying to think about situations outside of work versus where I am, or the way I'd like to perceive myself.
Yeah, so it brings up, and Marianne, we'll get to you in a second. So, you want to add? Right. Bring it in.
You know, I find it very context specific. How I relate to my children is very different than how I would relate to my patients.
Right.
And just to add to that, some of it's how you are and how you want to be.
Yes, that's the point. Yeah. I want to be Joe Lascalzo, not.
Right.
It's not that my to do what I would in the other context. It's that I really have two different instincts depending on the context.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Good, folks. I didn't want to interrupt this good conversation. Anyone else? Right. So this, the beauty of this conversation is this is, you know, making type real and figuring out how to kind of synthesize it into your experiences in life. And I'm not suggesting anything anyone said is right or wrong, but let me share with you a couple of observations that exist within the kind of personality type Jungian philosophy. So we don't have time to get derailed. I'm going to say these anyway, and then we can come back afterwards during the Q&A if you want to spend more time on it. One, Carl believed that you're hardwired. He believes that if you're an ENFJ, you are an ENFJ, whether you're at home or, you know, whatever. I mean, he believed that's where you are. And upon lots of self-introspection, whatever, even if you didn't think that, you would ultimately come to this place where, generally speaking, that's where you are predominantly. Now, does that mean that you can't be over here? And what he defined when there were people who were not clear is that it was just not clear for them. And that's where kind of the preference clarity, right? I mean, I think we may all know people who are very clear extroverts, right? I mean, they very clear extroverts, and people who we might know are very clear introverts. But Judy, like you, you're kind of straddling the middle. And Amelia, you said, you know, you are too. So for those folks, it's just not right or wrong. It's just a little bit harder. The second thing someone touched on, which I didn't say earlier, is part of why, you know, the myth about assessments are always the same every time you take them, is that sometimes it's unclear to the person taking it whether I'm doing this as at work or at home, right? So I don't know that we made that specific for everybody. So our intent was to do it as you are here. And then the second is sometimes people, because it is a self-paced, self-choice, forced choice, aren't sure how to answer, and am I answering how I am or how I want to be?
That's the point.
And I would suggest that the next time you take it or take any of these, you should, you know, the better place to start, not that you can't get there, but the better place to start is as I am. And then if I'm an extrovert, I wish I was a little bit more introverted, right? I learned how to, you know, not jump in every time somebody said something. I was always the first to raise my hand or whatever. You know, I'll, does that refer to anybody in this room? I don't know. There's help for you yet. So, or, you know, or if I was a sensor, wished I had more of a, you know, why do I always get drawn to the specifics? I wish I had, like, Ed, you know, this kind of way of looking at things that's much more unrestricted, right? And by right, I mean, those things can happen, but purists believe that we are hardwired, and purists believe that the test results are affected by a whole variety of factors, some I mentioned earlier, and some people who think they need to answer a certain way because it's going to be public within their company, so they say, you know, darn it, I'm a thinker. I don't want to be known as a feeler, or darn it, I'm a extrovert. I don't want to be known as an introvert, or I'm a judger. I don't want to be known as a sensor, I mean, as a perceiver, etc. So, anything else? Okay, let's do the last one. So, the first one was, where do I get my energy from and where do I direct my energy? The second two really had to do with decision-making. How do I take in information and what do I do with it? The last one is really one that exists within Carl Jung's work, but Myers-Briggs actually created it and added it. So it's a little different in respect to kind of his original work, but they found it to be inherent in the work, which is really, how do I orient myself to the world? How do I present myself in respect to how I connect with the world? And on that spectrum, and again, it's embedded in Carl Jung's work, he found really two discrete opposites. One were folks who wanted their world to be very structured. They wanted their folks to be very planned. These are folks who drive things to closure. Then he found that there were people who wanted their lives to be very unstructured, folks who didn't like to be constricted by time or place, etc. Always wanted to have open-ended opportunities and outcomes, and closure to them wasn't that important. And it's in the JP dichotomy, so the ones that the folks that are interested in getting to closure, they call judgers, and the ones that wanted to keep things open are called perceivers. Again, I don't love the labels. So judgers aren't really judging, which isn't necessarily a great word in our culture, but what they're doing is they're coming to a decision, so they're making a judgment and going. Whereas perceivers were just perceiving more information and taking in more information than maybe those that were needing to get to closure. So that's kind of how those words came about. So a lot of people think of it like tension. So in respect to the tension that's created in this particular dimension. So not making a decision for somebody who has a preference for judging creates tension for them. So they've got to get to a decision. They've got to get to an outcome. These are folks that you might see from time to time who are always on time. Because for them, not being on time creates tension. So they've got to get there. I will tell you that I'm, for example, just using myself as an example for the last hour, a very clear judger. So I am virtually always on time. My family hates me because we know more neighborhoods than friends that we're driving to go to dinner to because we get there early. And so we've got to drive around because we're certainly not going to get there, you know, at 7:01 for a 7 o'clock dinner, right? So always we're the first ones and, you know, no one else is there until 20 minutes later, including the next door neighbor, those types of things. So, you know, it creates a tension in respect to that. Whereas perceivers, it creates tension by having to make a decision. For them, it's, you know, having to make that choice and decision creates tension for them. So the release is being more open. Say, hey, we'll get there when we get there, right? I mean, what's the big deal? Don't worry about it. If we're late, we're late. What is it? It's dinner. What's going to happen, right? I mean, I'm like, no, it's not dinner. You know, we said we'd be there, right? So let's take a quick look at, you know, how these might. And again, go to your workbooks and just take a minute to make some quick checks next to the ones that I think might fit. How about spontaneous? How about likes to see what turns up? How about organize their lives? Systematic. Finishes tasks. Now, hold on. This is a tricky one. You see, we have two here. Finish tasks at the deadline and finish tasks for the deadline. What one is finish tasks at the deadline? Again, we're not suggesting that people who have a preference for perceiving can't get things done, that they're not on time, but for them, they're more likely, not always, more likely to be less than, more likely to do it late. Now, this one I struggle with because I'm very last minute. But I think part of the reason for that is I actually get some creative thoughts when I'm under pressure. And so I'm trying to do it 2 weeks earlier. You know, it's just not flowing. I'm trying to do it. You know, I know it's due. You know, I know I owe Peter this by Friday, blah, 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 blah. You know, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I just, it's hard for me. But but for me, it's more of a creativity. Okay, see, oops, I gave that away. Key part of presentations is correct. Usage of the remote. Right, casual. Finish tasks before the deadline. See flexibility as effective. And likes goals and results. Great. So these, as you can see, lead to the four dimensions that are Maya Cup personality type, extroverts and introverts, sensing intuition, thinking, feeling, judgment. Again, we said it enough, but it's worth saying again, regardless of where you fell within this, again, one of the myths is you can't be in other ways, and nothing in MBTI supports the fact that you can't, time to time, be what you choose to be as the situation arises. So those four dimensions lead to this combination. If you were to do combinations of all of them, of 16 types, and these are the 16 personality types, so all of you in taking your assessment came to one of these particular outcomes.
Are they all equally common, or are some combinations rare?
Great question. We have a chart we're going to look at in a minute. So I have a couple of things I want you guys to reflect on. So we'll hold that. Nicole will come back to that. All right, so what I'd like you to do is open up your workbook. And I'm going to be a little risky here, because almost all of you took the assessment, so there was some kind of outcome. But I want you to, based on what you've heard today, in the whopping 48 minutes that you've had to understand type, estimate and, you know, put yourself on this chart based on what feels right. So notice that we have our degree of clarity, very clear, moderate, and slight. So, you know, I did a quick example of what it might look like, right? So, you know, do I feel more extroverted or introverted in general, and how much do I feel that way? So just take a minute just to do it. And we'll give you a minute to think about it, to digest. I have time to do today is anytime you take the assessment, MBTI professionals will tell you, well, taking the assessment is not the outcome. The outcome is sitting with that person and doing what's called a verification. But you talk to them and you talk it through, because there may be, as we talked about today, reasons or things that they were thinking about. Through conversation may come to either to validate the outcome or come to a different conclusion. Ultimately, no one can tell you what your particular type is than you. So the test isn't trying to tell you, I don't care what you say, you're not a thinker, you're a feeler, right? When you're deep down saying to yourself, I'm a feeler. Because no test can, you know, validate exactly how you feel. So generally speaking, 90% of people agree with at least three out of four of their outcomes. So when they sit and do these assessments, 90% of the people that take it agree with three out of four. So if we had time, we'd, you know, go around the room, whatever. If yours don't match at all, you're certifiably insane. I'm just if it doesn't match at all, it could be a reflection of your taking of this information today. We went very quickly. This whole variety of reasons. Don't make anything out of it other than the fact that what you heard today and what how you processed it and the way that your assessment came out is just that's all it means. Okay. So, back to Nicole's question. So, on the next page of your handout, there's a chart. So, this chart is a reflection of statistics that are collected by the folks at and it talks about the degree of... Yeah, this is the U.S. of extroverts, introverts, sensors, intuitives, thinkers, feelers, judges, perceivers, in totality, as well as by gender. So take a minute just to look at that, and then I want to ask you a couple of questions. Sensing and intuition. And is there an observation anybody might have about that?
Most of us.
I'm sorry?
It's the most skew, right? The sensing intuition.
What do you mean? I'm sorry.
In other words, it's the most lopsided.
Right, it's the most skew, right. I mean, the others, I'm not suggesting this is statistically accurate.
Except for the feeling for Woody.
Well, that's the second part, right? So that's okay. Let's stick for the first one. So, so we see statistically... It's all good. It's all good, Amelia. It's all good.
We know how to ignore.
So we see in this, in this ongoing review of the American population that these numbers have stayed pretty true for many years. But one of the significant differences is the difference within sensing and intuition, that our population just has a much larger degree of folks that have a preference for sensing than a preference for intuition. So the second one, if you'd make that observation, Amelia, again, on thinking and feeling as it relates to female. What was your observation?
I'm giving you a
backdoor area.
So it's obvious. It's very interesting. The real gender is the one that has the most divergence by gender, by sex.
Right. So sensing is the only dimension of the four that has this type of divergence, skewing, and then the female category and the male category, but more the female category, on thinking and feeling is the only one that has the same dimension in our book.
It'd be very interesting, I think, as an epidemiologist, whether they're secular trends, because I would think that these would actually change over time as the dominant, what's appreciated in the culture. And for instance, as gender roles become less rigid,
yep.
I wonder, because I think there are a lot of men that are actually F's, but they've been trapped into being T's, because it's not acceptable to be an F. So I wonder if people are honest.
It's a great question. I think I'd love to know the answer too. I'd love to know a snapshot of what this was back in 1998.
Yeah.
So I'm going to see if I can find that.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Craig, yeah.
You said about in terms of the United States, we're with other countries like England, Japan.
Yep. Yeah, I don't have that information, and I don't know it myself, so I know that it does vary slightly within particular cultures based on those particular categories, and they do study and track those. So if that's of interest, I'll think of where I can get something that's snapshots of that.
Well, I think that's particularly important for our culture because people come here from all over the world, and yet the reality is they're fitting into the United States and in a United States academic environment. And so I think that, I mean, I see this sometimes, I mean, not to fall into stereotypes, but with Asian women, you know, where they, part of their culture is to be more introverted. And extroverted is, yeah, it goes against what's socially acceptable. And so I think, I mean, it's a gross exaggeration, but I wonder.
Yeah, let me see if I can also provide some information on that front. All right, so I wanted to look at the next one. Appendix B. Did we do... Yeah, so look at the two left columns, which are sensing. See, they both have the S. And look at the two right columns, which are intuition. They both have the N. And you see a difference, generally, the left two columns versus the right two columns on Appendix B. Anybody like to share an observation?
So the ones on the right are much less.
Yeah. Right. So this is consistent with what we saw before, that sensing is a much more predominant personality type in the U.S. So the numbers on the left, which are comprised of sensing, almost in all cases other than one of them that's at 8.1, are more dominant. So what this helps us do is we think about people interacting with people, you know, the folk, the likelihood of somebody being an S is just greater in our culture than somebody having an N. So it can help us as we kind of think about what's the likelihood, kind of who am I talking to and how am I connecting to them. And how about the two middle columns, which are the Fs, versus the two outer columns, which are the T's. So you see the two middle columns have F and the two outer columns have T. Any observations there? What was that?
You still see that huge skew, I guess.
Okay, so, right. So if you look at the F column in the middle, female is always higher than male. So a female, generally speaking, If you accept these statistics, are more likely to have a profile in the middle two columns. The two outside columns, which has the T's, the males are always higher statistically than the females. So, again, if you're talking with a male of the species, there's a greater likelihood, although it's not that that clear and specific, but you have a greater likelihood that that person's a T versus an F, hence are one of these profiles without the 16. So my point here is one was to show you some of the statistics and information as it relates to MBTI and overall, so how common is my particular profile type as well as how it varies by gender, but also to give you an idea that, you know, as you start understanding type a little bit more, there are clues and ways that you can hypothesize what somebody's type is, and part of it's as easy as gender, that somebody's more likely to be in this category than not. You could be wrong, but that's the likelihood of it. Okay, we get to the infamous Q&A period. So it's almost about 3 o'clock. So what we want to do is we'll take a few minutes to do Q&A, no rush. I'd rather spend time on Q&A than anything else. We'll do Q&A and then we'll break up into pairs, and we're going to do some discussion regarding the information that was shared today. So, again, it doesn't have to be questions. It could be observations. It could be thoughts. What's bouncing around in your head?
I guess I'm just really curious how to use this information. Like, I can recognize that I somebody else, but I don't know how do you then use it? And I know that my boss is probably a thinker. Introvert,
what's the best way to approach this style? And maybe that's not a question or an answer, but maybe it's more. Well, it is. First of all, it's a whole other workshop, right?
Yeah.
So I would tell you, in the work that I do, I spend very little time on education, and I spend all the time on action. This is great, right? All right, I know my type, and but what do I do, right? How can I use this information? So with more time and more training and more conversation, you have strategies, and there are things that any of us can do to both build our own self-awareness. So I know that I have a tendency to, how can I manage that by now knowing this a little bit more? And also, if I either know or can create a hypothesis of what my boss is, for example, what can I do differently that appeals to him? So a colleague in this industry, I love this phrase, says the golden rule doesn't apply to type, right?
Yeah.
The golden rule is do unto others as you want others done to you. And he says it's do unto others as they want done to them, right? So a quick example might be I had a boss at my former job. I have a preference for intuition, and I'm a feeler. She had a preference for sensing and was a thinker. So I never knew this stuff. And when I would go in to see her on a Monday after a long weekend, I'd be like, hey, Linda, how's it going? You know, did you have a great weekend? Oh, you know, the kid, blah, 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 blah. And inside she'd be like, no, shut up. Shut up, right? Yeah. So I learned that what I needed to go in was say, hey, Linda, what's on our agenda for today? Right? And then we would get to the, oh, you know, by the way, did you have a nice weekend, whatever, but... She needed more tangibility, right? So if I was to show her some information, she was a big fan of the 5-slide executive summary, right? I don't want to see 60 slides, right? I don't want to see all these creative graphics and whatever. Come in, tell me what you need, how you need it, and she'd be the best resource you could ever have, right? But for her, she needed that tangibility. So knowing that, right, I became better at going in and saying, hey, Linda, here's that report you needed. You know, one page, very black and white. And allow her to expand upon it as needed versus me thinking, you know, I wanted to go in the way Ed would present it, which is with all these graphics and multiple pages and things of that nature. Is that, I mean, that's just a quick example, but that's one way that you can use information that way.
There are also cultural norms, though. And so if a woman comes off as an, doesn't come off as an F, if she walks in and she's like all business with the secretary and doesn't schmooze the secretary or the nurse about the kids, then she's... you're perceived as more of a bitch, you know? I mean, that's the reality, you know?
And you can, so, you can quote her on that.
It's true.
It's true. I mean, I had to be taught how to make chit-chat.
How did you do?
My husband actually had to teach me because I didn't know how to make chit-chat.
And how's that going?
Yeah,
but
she's out of her element.
Yeah, but the other token, I think, is that it's going to a meeting, you know, sort of higher up. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's sort of what Ed was saying. You don't want to chit-chat, and so...
Right.
And if you do, then you're perceived as, oh, well, it's the woman, and she wants to talk to her kids. Or,
right.
You know, so...
That's the point, is you have to be very contextual about how you bring these things out. So whenever I meet with my boss, I try... Very, very, particularly when I meet with my enemies and frenemies, I try very, very hard to go completely into tea and completely eliminate all feelings. Like, it's just absolutely essential that I have no feelings whatsoever.
I don't know, so you mean all the bosses are all thinkers, they don't have any feelings?
They probably do, they just, it's not, you know, they don't bring them to work.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned that earlier, right? That one way at home and one way. So in an extreme case, somebody might, you know, in order to survive in their work environment, behave and act in a certain way that's not the normal state. Now, again, we would tell you that because each of these preferences are generated by energy, that person's not going to survive, right? I mean, they just can't keep that up. And they're going to, especially, you know, in some of the dichotomies that have to do with energy, I mean, the person just won't be able to keep that up. And at some point, they're either going to wake up and say, what am I doing? Or they're just going to crash, right? Because it's just not their natural style. Making effort in an area of the dimension that's not your natural way takes energy. It takes thought, you know, it takes thought, it takes effort. Yes, Judy?
I think everything's relative. I mean, I've worked with one person who's a really strong introvert. And I'm sort of, you know, I can go either way in terms of
extrovert.
Yeah, I am. So... when I work with that person, you know, I realize that I have to be respectful of her space because she has to think through everything for a period of time before we can actually come to a decision. And you know, I'm there, let's do it right now. And she wants to just go through and think about all the intent. I mean, it's just amazing. And so over time, over 15 years, we've learned to worked really effectively together, but it took some time to learn how to do that. And if you understand somebody's type or hypothesize about their type, you know, it makes it easier to work with allies and frenemies. I love that term. It's so great.
The other piece is that I think what I've been working on is it's okay to have my reaction, but this is what my coach talks about. There's the reaction, and then there's right action, which is acting in the way that's in my career best interest, when I really just want to say, you know, bugger off, but not in such polite language. You know, that probably isn't a winning strategy, though that's what I'm, you know, I'm boiling over, and so I go into kindergarten teacher voice when I'm really angry, you know, because that's the only way I can survive.
But what I think what that is similar to is the experience within personality type, where there's your original, you know, there's your hardwired reaction.
Exactly.
And then the beauty of this information is self-awareness, right? So I now choose, I can choose what way I'm going to go. And I'm going to be either less sensing or more sensing, or less perceiving, more perceiving. And through education and knowledge, you learn some of the ways and strategies to do that. So Peter reminds me that, you know, the topic was, you know, negotiating, in a what's the environment? What word?
Complex
environment, right? So I would add something to that, saying, you know, negotiating complex. I wrote it down. So the title is "Negotiating Relationships in Complex Environments" is our topic today. And I would have added something to it, which is negotiating complex relationships in complex environments, right? Because those can be just as complex, and we're also just as affected by our environment. So I know people are in certain companies who, their experience of that company, even though they haven't changed, is much different than somewhere else, just because the culture and the environment is just so different. It's just not their way of navigating life. So yes, I think everything that we've heard today is true, right? In respect to it being contextual, there's gender, there's cultural bias, basics to information. Again, keeping in mind that what we're talking about are preferences and indicators. They're not, you know, you are this way, you can't do anything else. Judy, I like what you described in respect to, you know, so I put in some strategies in order to work with this person more effectively. So, you know, it's coming to those types of terms of how can I, you know, understand others more effectively and respect their differences such that we can work together in a more productive and effective way. So you could become junior hypothesizers. So in sitting back, someone you work with, say, you know, if I was to guess, you don't have to be 100% right, because even if you've got a couple right, you're already made. You know, if I've got somebody that I'm having a challenging relationship with or I want to get to know better, what would I guess? You know, are they E and I and S and N? And then are there a couple of things that I could do to maybe enhance that relationship by thinking of things that relate more to them than just always doing it the way I think? All right, what else? Any other thoughts, observations? Yep, Marianne.
Just making your call because certainly earlier in my career, it was very much playing out my personality in those situations where I was in charge, and then having to adapt to all kinds of personalities in the situations where I wasn't in charge. And, you know, through the years, I guess I've now got a reputation as being person A, which is much closer to the real me. And so I don't have to play the game as much, even when I go to meet with people who are in charge who have different structures. So I'm just kind of curious how over time, you know, I've been allowed much more space to be me than I was 25 years ago.
It depends upon whether you're in a toxic environment or not.
That's probably true.
So if you're in a toxic, I mean, there are certain people that in my universe that are toxic, and I cannot go to my natural space. It would be career suicide. Career suicide. I have to acknowledge my reaction, not feel bad about it, but then I have to choose very carefully, or else I'm done. And then the people that I like working with, which I just accept for who I am.
And that's why we like them, right? I
mean, well, and one of the things that I've done is I've tried to increasingly surgically excise those other people.
So we didn't touch base, so thank you. I mean, we didn't touch base on the article that Peter had also searched, which I think is just awesome. So it's a great balance to this concept of personality But no, if you're going to spin your wheels trying to turn an enemy into a friend, right, with all of the hypothesizing that you can do, probably may not be a good use of your time, right? There may be better strategies. But if you have allies and adversaries through simple ways of doing things just slightly differently, who could shift along that continuum, be closer to a friend, an ally, you know, then, you know, that might be worth the effort. So if you haven't read that article, I would strongly encourage you to read it, because I thought it was just great insight. And having been in corporate for as many years as I had, you know, I wish I had read that, because there were definitely people who I thought were friends.
Yeah.
Who, you know, as soon as I moved on to another job, I never heard from them again. I'm like, Francine, come on, I thought we were buddies. And they're like, what are you talking about? That's just the way I act with them. They weren't really that good friends. So, yes.
Yeah, so does that mean that if you have similar personality types, you're more like friends?
Guess say that again?
No.
If you have the same personality types, like, so it's sort of...
No.
Right.
No, I mean, I would imagine... So I haven't done a lot of study in that particular area. So the answer, though, a couple of folks said no, it's no. I mean, great friends are great friends for a whole variety of reasons other than personality.
You have a better work relationship?
It could be a whole number of dimensions, right? Respect to interests, skills,
think about
things you have
your
in common.
Think about your partner. Yeah. Like, do you test the same way as your partner?
I know. I just think of what, if you're playing up to somebody's personality to try to get in with them, right? Like, to look at your boss's personality score, trying to figure out if he's an E or a T to get in with them, then...
Well,
I don't. There has to be some connection there.
Well, this
if it works, play up to people's personalities.
Well, I think people may be initially drawn to folks who have a similar, you know, just at the surface level, right? I mean, in some ways, maybe drawn, but by no means does it then say because 2NF, you know, if you have 2NFJs, they're going to be best friends. I have a colleague who I do work with, the ENFJ extreme, and you know, drives me crazy, right? I mean, I'm an ENFJ, but they're really an ENFJ, right? They're more ENFJ than I am, right? So I don't think there's causality to type and relationship. And I think there's been work done, the opposites attract, right?
Yeah.
There's a concept of, you know, somehow people like people who are different than them. It exposes them to a whole different way of thinking about things and way of looking at the world, et cetera.
And I do wonder if there's something about productive if there's different. I mean, I spent a chief year with a guy. We did this testing thing, and he and I were literally like on opposite ends of the extreme for every single one. But we found that during the year, we divided the work up that way. Like I did the schedules. People called me when they needed something like done right away, and they called Lewis when they needed someone to talk to and like, cry and all that useless feeling stuff that I. Like, okay, wait, no, I'll so-and-so. It turned out that when he was put in charge of the schedule, it was a disaster.
Yeah,
and it was crazy. So over the year, we divided the work up in a way that worked really, really, really well. And we didn't think we were going to work together at all.
Yeah.
But that was because we were equals and we were able to do that. And so I don't know where it comes when, you know.
Your boss or
chair.
Yeah.
But even if your boss is something that's really different from you, if you understand how they're different, and you can support them in a way that's effective for both of you. You know, I used to work with this person who was an ENFP. So he had the vision thing, okay? But he couldn't do any details at all. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And he never came to a conclusion. And so we really had to figure out how to work with this guy. Now, we were really productive. But it took a lot of doing, and it was a very interesting process of learning how to work with them. And I think, you know, that's what you have to do is just take these ideas and if you can't figure somebody out, you know, try to apply these to see if you can just work out how to more effectively get things done with them.
I think the key is it helps you be more respectful when people are different. It's like, well, of course they're different, and this is the basis of it. And so it's not a matter of like they're doing it wrong, you know? They're doing it the way that feels comfortable.
Right.
So I think it, for me, it helps me understand. Like, I work with an extreme eye. And, you know, I've just had to learn over the years to, like, really ramp it down, you know, in terms of, you know, it is, you know, complete taciturn. And it's helpful. And it also makes me feel better about who I am. Because I couldn't be him if I wanted to be.
I guess I'm concerned about what it says if you feel like you're completely two different personalities, one at work and one at home. Are you in the wrong field?
I second that question.
I'll give you some of my reactions. I think it's actually kind of appropriate because most of us are not pure anything.
Yeah.
And
right.
Therefore, sometimes you want to express the other part of you. And so you may be in balance. Only you can judge that. Then you're schizophrenic. You just have to break. But you may be in balance by relating to the other part of your personality.
I hope. One of my colleagues is a big monkey mind. And they went to their first leadership training program and they were told, people like you never succeed. They cannot be in charge. You know, and yeah, I mean, sort of very, very extreme in that way. And actually, if you understand kind of what makes you comfortable, like if you're a P, then, you know, you figure out how to scaffold yourself so you get stuff done. But also, you know, the people will honor you because you're the person who kind of like, you know, stir it up and you know, think thoughts.
I do wonder though, it's easier for people. Fields have their personality. Everybody is there to do it. And I'm really a team. Yeah, I remind myself to like, so I wonder sometimes if it's just less of stress and strain if people are in. Like if you're, you know, if surgeons have that particular personality,
yeah.
Is it just less of a strain if they act that way at that way?
Huh.
Less strain.
I'm a psychologist by training. I don't know the Myers-Briggs research as well as I know research on the Big Five, which is some of the similar personality characteristics, but speak to some of what you guys were saying. There's research that shows that it can be very domain-specific. So you can be at work and not social contact, for example. So there is research to show that personality can be predictive, but it can be domain-specific, so depending on whether you're friends or with family or at work, that it can vary by the don't.
So I think we're saying you're good.
Direct it to
you. Okay, all right.
Don't worry what stays in the room. Stays in the room.
So
we also called it.
So, whoever you were asking that about.
I'm a friend. I don't feel protected here.
Might help us sort of bring this
work. Yeah, oh, thank you. Right. Yeah, so I did the folks that completed an assessment, we got back 16. So this is the distribution of type in this room. So before I pass it out, not that there's anything fantastic about it, I just wanted to say, other than the fact that it's very distributed, you know, everything we're talking about, I think, supports and feeds the concept that, again, we're talking about preferences, not concrete answers, and that we have the ability, if anything, to just build our awareness of our own likelihoods as it relates to personality, so that we can be more self-aware, manage that more effectively, and then hypothesize or get information or ideas about the style of others so that might modify and think a little bit. Doing the things the way we think on everybody, it naturally just doesn't work, right? But if I can tweak it, twist some things in certain ways because I know that's going to feeling connected to somebody, which they feel better, feel like progress is made, those might be things worth considering and taking into that. So this is the distribution type.
Can we avoid the male-female breakdown?
That is too funny. Yeah. It's, you know, democracy, you can never put less than, like, you know, five in a cell. So hopefully you didn't do the male-female thing. Yeah.
Well, I will tell you, I started to do it, but actually the reality is that our statistical basis is 10. And then Peter had made an observation. Peter, what was your observation about distribution earlier?
Well, they're clustered.
Yeah.
And then some areas with none, but there's a great diversity too.
But you also said something about who we all are and kind of...
About the academic
role. Yeah.
That favors certain traits over others.
Yeah. Studies have been done that certain industries, certain vocations tend to, I'm not saying exclusive, tend to attract certain people based on personality. So to do a group of you know, folks who are in the medical profession and have a number as low as 16, you probably expect to have a great spread. But to know, you know, that's those are your colleagues. So I think 12, the majority of folks have a preference for extrovert version. Is that surprising? Or are you not surprised by it?
Well, it's not surprising.
Especially we applied to this program. I mean, it's a year of workshopping.
I think also it's one of the fields you've got to be a speaker, you got to be, you know, talk to patients all the time. You know, like you're an extrovert, but it means you got to be, you know, part of your personality if you're okay dealing with that.
Yeah. Okay. How about, I gave mine away, thanks. I was wondering about the, going back to our weather analysis, the F's in the middle versus the T's at the outside.
Yeah.
12 T's.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
I'm telling you, you're a minority if you're an F in an academic setting. You're really not supposed to be an F. It's like, especially if you want to have any kind of
charge
of anything.
No, it's okay
for a guy. In my ELAM class, one of the people was an F. She was talking about how she never wanted to be number one. She wanted to be the number two person in a med school. You know, and that's what she is. And she was really an effective participant in our group.
It's very possible. Again, while Jung would say that, speaking for him, he's not here to dispute my observation, that while we're all hardwired, I think Jung and Isabel and Catherine would say that all of us can be anything that we want to be, that it's not just about personality. There are indicators, there are preferences, there are things that are more likely, but it doesn't restrict or confine us to what we want to do and how we want to do it and how we navigate our way through the world. All of the preferences, whether you're a thinker, feeler, are just ways that you function. They're not good or bad in respect to, you know, how you navigate and find your way through the world. So I made an executive decision, Peter, as we're going through, to let the conversation go and forego the exercise. So we'll close off with any other last comments, observations. Our extreme extrovert wants to say one last thing before we're done. That's
one of the things that I think is interesting is when you think about your domestic situation, what fights you have, you know, that you like a recurring fight. Because for me, it's always about this kind of on the dimensionalities where we're different. It's interesting. Like getting places on time.
So is your significant other a perceiver or a judge?
He is definitely, we are diametrically opposite except for in one dimension. So.
Yeah, I differ with my spouse. I'm an intuitive and she's a sensor. So to no great surprise, she does the checkbook. Because when I get a paycheck, I'm like, oh, we're going to get a new TV. And she's like, give me the check. It's going in the checkbook. We have these six things that you forgot about that we have to pay, blah, 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 right? Blah, 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 blah. So I would be a disaster if I had control of the checkbook. Any other last-minute thoughts, observations, comments, questions? All right, well.